Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Labor Department measures unemployment in this country dozens of ways. It's got more tables and charts than you can shake a stick at. Bear that in mind as I tell you that the headline jobless numbers that came out this morning, they were the good ones. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, today the 3rd of April, and it is good to have you here as always. The Bureau of Labor Statistics offers its monthly unemployment figures every which way, by age and sex, education level and ethnicity, by reason for and duration of unemployment. But no matter how you chop them up, this morning's numbers were grim. In all, more than 5 million jobs have evaporated from the U.S. economy since the recession started 16 months ago. The unemployment rate last month rose to 8.5%. And Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that when you look a little bit deeper, the details get even worse.
More than 660,000 Americans lost their jobs last month, and the ranks of the long-term unemployed are rising.
We have never had long-term unemployment this high in the middle of a recession, and it's approaching an all-time record.
Andrew Stentner is an analyst at the National Employment Law Project. He says nearly one in four unemployed workers has been looking for a job for more than 6 months.
You already have a lot of long-term unemployment. At the same time, new people are being laid off.
Stentner says for every new job out there, there are four unemployed workers who want it.
There's just so little hiring going on that it feels like a game of musical chairs you can't win.
Mary Domke feels lucky, although she's one of millions who are underemployed.
It's a tough economy, so I'm just happy that I am one of the few people who has their job, and hopefully I will keep my job.
Domke is an aide at a nursing home in Scandia, Minnesota. If she works full-time, she gets health insurance. Over the summer, she was close, averaging 36 hours a week.
Now I'm back down to about 28 to 32 hours a week.
That means less money and no health insurance. Stender says Domke's experience is common.
There's over 9 million workers who don't have full-time hours but really want them, and that's crushing.
When you add it all up, unemployed, underemployed, and folks who have just given up and stopped looking, nearly 17% of Americans don't have the jobs they need. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Two more unemployment items before we move on today, one promising, one perhaps not. There is a chance that today's numbers might be a sign of better times. Bad as they were, they are a marked improvement from the January report. It was revised upward today to 750,000 jobs lost. On the flip side, the way things are going, the unemployment rate is rising, 0.1% each and every week. This is going to sound like an odd thing to say after all we've been through, but you can read things in the financial press even today that make you say, oh, I don't know if that's such a good idea. You remember the Obama administration's plan to have private investors help buy up some of those mortgage-backed securities, the ones that are weighing down bank balance sheets? What do you suppose might happen if banks decided they wanted to invest in the very program that's supposed to let them unload their bad debts? Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott is on that story.
The idea that banks could buy the very kinds of troubled assets they're supposed to be selling has lit a fire under Spencer Backus. He's the top Republican on the House Financial Services Committee. In response to a report in the Financial Times that banks might actually do this, he offered a bill last night to try to stop them.
The idea is to get the toxic assets off their books, not to swap them around at taxpayer expense. If they end up selling and buying assets among themselves, it accomplishes nothing.
The FT named Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley. The banks either declined to comment or didn't return our calls. Backus's plan is light on details. He says he's hoping to drum up public outrage. His objections? That the banks could unload bad loans and mortgage-backed securities through the Treasury's plan and then turn around and buy other assets, with Uncle Sam taking on most of the risk. Chris Whalen is managing director of Institutional Risk Analytics. He says banks are already buying up distressed assets on the cheap in hopes of selling them at higher prices when the Treasury's auctions begin.
It's another government arbitrage. You buy at 30, you sell at 80. It's great. I'd do that trade all afternoon.
Kidding aside, Whalen says the loopholes show the flaws in the Treasury's plan.
If you want to throw money at banks, there's a much more creative and direct way to do it. Is you restructure them and you put more government money in so that we know they're solid, and then we're done.
Politically, that could be a tough sell, but Whalen says then we could all move on to fixing the rest of the economy. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Working backward from today's unemployment report, you might imagine Wall Street would have thrown in the towel early today. Traders, though, had other ideas. We will have the details when we do the numbers. A key part of the Obama administration's plan to turn the housing market around hinges on restructuring mortgages for people who are in trouble. Stands to reason, right? If a homeowner can't make payments and the lender comes in and substantially reduces the monthly amount due, then you'd think the borrower has a better chance of staying current with the mortgage and so a better chance of staying in the house. A study released today by federal banking regulators confirmed that that is what happens, unless it doesn't. From Washington, Tamara Keith reports that most of the loan modifications made last year didn't stick.
Let's say your adjustable rate mortgage adjusted right out of reach. You call your lender hoping for some help, a loan modification. Well, there's a whole lot of things the lender might offer. It could cut your interest rate a couple of points, saving you hundreds a month. It could extend the term to 40 years. It could even reduce what you owe on the home. But more often than not, lenders have been offering payment plans that don't cut monthly payments. More than 30% of modifications last year actually led to higher payments. David Barenbaum is with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
Many of these modifications were not affordable to the consumer, and ultimately, because they were unsustainable, will still lead to default.
Which misses the point. But the good news is that trend appears to be shifting. In the latest data crunched by federal regulators, at the end of last year, there was a jump in the percentage of loan modifications where monthly payments were trimmed.
What we see is that that certainly works.
Gravetta Gardiner oversaw today's report for the Federal Office of Thrift Supervision. The report found that cutting monthly payments by more than 10% is what works. Those borrowers were far less likely to get behind again.
If the payments are actually reduced, then the redefault rate is lower.
Obama administration officials say the point of their new foreclosure prevention plan is loan modifications that reduce payments. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
As we mentioned up top, job losses continue to be the hallmark of this recession, and today's numbers were less than hopeful. But in fairness, there have been a couple of signs that things might, and we stress might, here be getting less bad. To help us do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we turn once again to John Carney from ClusterStock.com and Megan McArdle. She's an editor at the Atlantic's Business Channel. Hi, guys. How are you?
Pretty good.
I'm great.
So listen, John, let me go to you first and sort of raise the proposition that despite today's job numbers, maybe things aren't so bad out there. What do you think?
It's looking pretty good today. And this whole week, we've had a bunch of news that isn't quite good, but not catastrophic, which is a big change. And the markets have responded very well to that.
Have we decided to fool ourselves, though, Megan, that believing maybe the bottom is nigh?
I think if you look at the standard length of time after a big recession, especially a recession that starts with a financial crisis, it doesn't really look very likely that we've bottomed. It seems more likely that we've got about a year to go. You know,
a year to go to the bottom?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. If you look at charts showing what happens to, say, stock prices after the start of a recession, how many months into the recession you are, it's very unlikely that we've bottomed. It would be historically one of the fastest bottoms ever. So I'm skeptical.
Well, let's step back for a minute, though, and look at the bigger picture. We had the president getting very serious with the car companies earlier this week. We had the mark-to-market rule yesterday. We had the G20 meeting where everybody seems to agree that there's a big problem. I mean, Megan, doesn't that tell you, I don't know, something?
Well, it tells you something, but so far the president has talked tough with the auto companies, and I don't want to be too pessimistic because talking tough is better than weaseling. But that said, he actually hasn't pushed an automaker into bankruptcy. What the government is currently trying to do is protect a lot of UAW jobs, and that's at odds with fixing the companies. It's not merely a question of the wages and benefits that are paid the UAW. It's the fact that the UAW fiercely resists having plants closed for obvious reasons. Close a plant, lose jobs. And all of that is going to be incredibly painful, and it's going to devastate Michigan. And it seems tough to picture Obama actually doing that in the face of the inevitable hit to GDP that we would take, because it is a big part of GDP.
John, I don't want to be the guy who's incessantly looking for the silver lining here, but there has to be some upside. I mean, people are getting sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know what I mean?
There's little signs of hope everywhere. Even in Obama's tough talk with the car companies, there's stories out today that he got pretty tough with the bankers as well when he had his summit with them, that he told them, look, guys, you've got to stop trying to pull the same lines about having to pay at people large bonuses. That's not going to fly. So, you know, maybe he's finding his spine. And that's a good sign. Because
I would differ with John in saying that I think it's nice that he's talking tough to Wall Street about bonuses, but this is fundamentally not a very interesting issue. It really doesn't matter how much these guys get paid. It's totally irrelevant to whether or not we fix the banking system.
All right, well then, what is the answer? What do you want him to be doing?
Well, what I would like to see is some movement forward on these plans to buy assets. I'd like to find out if anyone's going to invest in these other than PIMCO.
The big bond fund,
the big
right?
bond, yeah, the big bond fund. And so, you know, I'm not sure that I am in a position to dictate exactly what I would like to see Treasury doing. What I would like to see is more sort of steady motion forward and more reassurance that what they're doing is actually having some buy-in from Wall Street and from Main Street. And that's not clear yet.
Yeah. John, would you settle for that steady movement forward?
Anything besides movement backward at this point, you know, if we could just stand still, you know, it just feels like we're slipping downhill a little bit every day. And buying toxic asset plans is another one of these things. We know PIMCO said they'd buy it, but we're hearing from more and more people. Just yesterday, Bridgewater Associates said they initially were planning on buying in on it, and they are now officially backing out. That's backward movement, and you know, I'd like to see a little bit less of that.
John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Megan McArdle is the senior editor at the Atlantic's Business Channel. Thanks again, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And now, let's do the numbers. Wall Street somehow took those job cuts in stride. The Dow Industrials rose 39 points today, 0.5%, closed at 8,017. The NASDAQ climbed 19 points, 1.2%, ended things at 1,621. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, nearly 1%, finished the day and the week at 842. For the 5 days gone by, it was a good one. The Dow bumped up 0.3%. The NASDAQ rose 5%. The S&P 500 added 0.3%. The government is going to change how it's going to reimburse for Medicare. That is not good news for elder care providers. Tenet Healthcare fell 6% today. Humana lost 5%. Coventry Healthcare dropped 4%. Auto seller CarMax lost 8.5% today after it was downgraded to underperform. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
from the Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at events coming up Monday. President Obama is scheduled to be in Turkey, his final stop on an 8-day tour of Europe. A report is released at the National Press Club rating the quality of the nation's airlines. It's based on arrival times, mishandled baggage, and other factors. And on April 6, 1947, the first Tony Award ceremony took place at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. Event tickets were a whopping $7. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The NCAA basketball tournament begins its long wind down this weekend, but another tournament wraps up tonight, the College Basketball Invitational. You're not going to find any real powerhouses playing in the CBI, but for one team tonight, just being there is a win, and its turnaround could be seen as a parable for the whole economy. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Ethan Lindsay reports.
The 60-year-old basketball court at Oregon State's Gill Coliseum has seen a lot of basketball. But nobody expected a nearly packed house and a high-stakes game this late into this postseason. Outside the arena, grad student Brian Rebar clutched to his tournament tickets as if they were for the Super Bowl. He says last year's team was tough to watch because the school went winless in the Pac-10 conference.
It was painful, but I came out because you're always hopeful.
After the season, the school forced out its losing coach and hired Craig Robinson, who was First Lady Michelle Obama's older brother.
The connection to the White House was pretty exciting. He's charismatic and motivational.
And that motivation is key not just for basketball, says philosopher Jerry Walls. He says Robinson's powerful brother-in-law might want to pay attention to what's going on at Oregon State.
A lot of what is involved in being a successful basketball coach is motivating people, getting people to believe in themselves.
Outside the Beavers' locker room after a win this week, Coach Robinson says much the same thing. And he echoes a word President Obama has used a lot recently, persistence.
You have to have the discipline and the confidence to know what you're doing is the right thing to do.
Robinson says after a loss, he often gets criticism. People tell him he should change the way his team plays. He says the president gets the same sort of heat when the Dow drops 100 points.
53% of the people voted for him, the others didn't. So those people are going to be detractors anytime something goes wrong. It's sort of the same in basketball.
Robinson says other hoops lessons like discipline and playing within yourself can apply to handling the broader economy as well. Back at the game, some fans say they're now more hopeful for a possible economic recovery for the country. After all, they say, just look at the turnaround that's taken place on the Oregon State hardwood. In Corvallis, Oregon, I'm Ethan Lindsay for Marketplace.
The rapper Busta Rhymes has a new album in the works, but the first single is already out. It's a song about money with kind of a twist. It's called Arab Money because apparently flying to Dubai to play golf in the desert is the new bling. The song is controversial, even among Busta's Arab fans. They say it's ignorant, even racist. So one of them has busted out his own rhyme in response. Marketplace's Sean Cole reports.
Yassin Al-Salaman, a.k.a. The Narcissist, is an Iraqi rapper living in Montreal. He's an independent artist, records and performs socially conscious songs about war and racial profiling, and he remembers the moment, last fall, that he first heard Arab Money.
I was actually hopping out the shower to get ready to get on a plane to come to Dubai, and it was playing on the radio. And I was like, what is this? Is this, like, serious?
We getting Arab Money. We getting Arab.
Now there ain't no way that you could kill a beast dead. I got Middle East women and Middle East bread. I got oil well.
Now, Busta Rhymes is a huge rap star, and Yassin is a huge fan, but he had some issues with this track.
The word Arab, you know, you could say Arab money.
The chorus, which is a bunch of random sounds passed off as Arabic. Plus, there's the small matter of the lyrics.
I'm looking kind of weird, dude. I got that Arab money, I'm growing my beard, dude, or something like that.
Get fresh, about to grow beard, dude. So much cake, even the money look weird, too. Domestic bread.
I just got offended. Me personally, as an individual, I was offended.
A lot of Arabs were. And Busta defended himself on TV and radio. He wouldn't talk to me, but he told Hot 98.1 in South Carolina that he was trying to celebrate Arab culture, especially regarding finance.
The family inherits the success of the prior family in the lineage of the bloodline, and they know how to take what the prior family in the lineage of the bloodline did to another level of profit.
But Yassine had a problem with this idea, too.
If you're going to big up a culture, don't big it up through money. Big it up through the beautiful things in the culture. Because money is international. Like, everyone has money in their country.
So anyway, Yassine flies to Dubai. He had a role in a movie there. And the song is bumping in all the clubs. And he tells a friend of his, I feel real funny about this. And the friend says,
you know what? Why don't you record a response track?
A parody, basically. He's done a bunch of these.
So he was like, you make him really funny. Why don't you remake Arab Money? Hey, yo, this song is so racist right now. So I sat down, I wrote it in like 15 minutes and then just went in the booth and recorded it. Let these brothers know what the Middle East is about. Misrepresent us in Dubai. It ain't Arab money. It's called Arab money. Alayinak means may God like show you that it's more than this, it's more than money. Even if you never heard of me verbally, you should have done your research about the current state of currency. We hurt way more than we ball in Palestine. Kids can't shop at these malls. My nation. So this version goes up on the internet, and a website about hip-hop interviews Yassine. And within like 30 minutes of it getting posted, his manager called me out here and was like, Busta Rhymes wants to speak to you.
Okay, wait. So Yassine had been struggling away in relative obscurity for 10 years. And he does this little throwaway track, and suddenly one of the biggest names in hip-hop is like, let's chat.
He was very apologetic and was like, I didn't mean to disrespect the Arab community, you know, I didn't expect this kind of backlash from Muslims.
Yassine explained his concerns, and Busta said he was taking the song off the radio.
Which he did, you know, and they changed the word Arab on the song to Arab.
There's a lot more to the story. Busta Rhymes did a remix using the first two lines of the Quran as the chorus. Again, this is in a song about money, women, and drinking, so a lot of Muslims got even madder. Ironically, Busta himself identifies as Muslim. But the true irony, lost in all of this, is that the Dubai economy is contracting. Real estate there is imploding. Arab money isn't exactly what it used to be.
Yeah, they should do credit crunch money. I'm getting bailout money.
I know, I'm getting bailout money.
I left my car at the airport with my Visa card in it. That's what should be going on, you know?
But it's not. The other night I walked past this house party here in Boston, and guess which song is blaring out of the windows? It was the original version, with the word Arab in it. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Christie's Auction House in New York City is about as far away as you can get from being a pawn shop, though they do have some similarities, offering previously owned goods for cash down. Those parallels were extended today. An anonymous bidder paid $460,000 for a guitar that once belonged to Roy Rogers, an OM-45 Deluxe Martin that Rogers bought at a pawn shop in 1933 for $30. Today's hammer price is a long way from what Rogers paid. Still, you'd expect pawn shops to do pretty well in a recession. But for owners of those shops, too much of a good thing can mean owning too many good things. From the Denver suburb of Aurora, Colorado, Zachary Barr reports.
Scott Pasternak's been in the pawn business 25 years, and he's never seen it like this. He says most people used to just get $50 loans to pay their electric bill, and now
they need $300, $500 to pay their mortgage. So they're bringing in bigger dollar items like the plasma TVs, the nice pieces of jewelry, the artwork.
These are the spoils of boom times. And for one customer, her most valuable possession is a shotgun.
This is a nice Winchester, 1300 Defender. That's a nice piece, sweetie. That's great.
I think I bought it here.
You have good taste.
Yeah. Here's how it works. Think of the pawn shop like a bank, only one that's outside the credit market. Using the gun as collateral, a customer named Christina borrows $130. If she returns in a month to repay the loan, plus 10% interest, she gets her gun back.
That's my gun, yeah. I'll be back. Yeah, I don't plan on losing it.
Losing it is rarely part of the plan. For now, the gun goes into a back room for storage. That's where owner Scott Pasternak is standing, surrounded by flat-screen televisions and boxes full of DVDs.
The walls are bulging at the seams. Everywhere we look, we have a mess just trying to find space to put these items.
When a loan isn't repaid, the items from this storage room go to the sales floor. And these days, more customers are defaulting, 40% compared to the usual 25%. That's not great news for shops, because now they have to sell those pawned items to get their money back. It's just like when a bank repossesses a foreclosed home. In fact, Pasternak says some pawn shops in this neighborhood are running out of money to lend out.
A lot of the bigger shops, they have signs on their doors that they're out of cash, can't make any more loans. It gets very tricky in the economy like this.
On top of the cash flow problem, there are fewer shoppers, especially for expensive things, like gold jewelry.
The refiners are really the only ones who have money. So what we're doing is, even the nicer jewelry, if it comes out, we're actually scrapping it, just sending it to the refiner to be melted and getting paid the market value just so we can keep the cash flow turning.
Most of the gold never makes it onto the sales floor. As for the power tools, lawnmowers, and mountain bikes, there's always the old standby, lower prices.
Everything's cheap or inexpensive, that's a better word.
Pasternak's ready to make a deal. It's a buyer's market, he says, where you can expect to pay about half the retail price for anything in the store. In Aurora, Colorado, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes today. First, and I am going to date myself with this one, but you remember leisure suits, right? One of the more unfortunate mementos of the 1970s. If Sears has its way, they might be coming back. The company said this week it's going to start selling men's suits made out of polyester from recycled soda bottles, fully machine washable and dryable. Like, that's a positive. To be fair, soda bottles do turn into really comfortable fleece. I'm just not so sure about that suit part. And an item sure to make for good water cooler conversations. An Australian researcher says surfing the internet on the job can actually increase worker productivity. Management specialists from the University of Melbourne say that as long as it's kept within reason, browsing on company time can add as much as 9% to your output. It's all about gauging how long a person can really concentrate on one task without productivity slipping. Within reason is defined as less than 20% of the time you're at work, which in a 5-day work week could be almost a full day of doing nothing at all. We are going to spend 2 days doing nothing at all. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 39 points, 0.5%, closed at 8,017. The NASDAQ gained 19 points, 1.2%, ended at 1621. The S&P 500 put on 8 points, nearly 1%, finished at 842 this Friday. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, a first for summer renters on Cape Cod.
Homeowners are starting to lower their prices already. Definitely, there's a nervousness out there that we have never seen, which comes as no surprise, given the economy that we have never seen before.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.